You're tuned to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Gavin Dahl. This week, I asked two Democrats, Representative Barbara McLaughlin, who lives in Durango, and Ian Silveri, the executive director of Progress Now and a fiery Denver Post columnist, to reflect on the special session, the 2020 election, and the coronavirus pandemic. Last week, we heard from two Republicans. You can check that out on our website, kvnf.org. Stay tuned. This is Local Motion. Democratic State Representative Barbara McLaughlin joins me by phone from Durango. Thanks for speaking with KVNF.
Thank you, Gavin. Thanks for inviting me today.
You represent District 59 in the State House, and you're the chair of the Education Committee. I've been looking forward to meeting you since I started here. KVNF broadcasts to quite a few people who live or work in your district, but most of our listeners likely don't know the exact lines of Colorado's political maps. What are the counties in your district, and what draws you to working at the state capitol on their behalf?
I have six counties, so I represent Archuleta, La Plata, San Juan, Silverton, Ouray, half of Gunnison, and Hinsdale County, which is the smallest county in the state, I think. I think I have the most beautiful district in Colorado, but people argue with me all the time, so I just I keep saying it and they keep arguing, but I usually win. So, I was a high school teacher and I retired and I thought, oh, finally I'm going to have lunch downtown. I don't have to eat in my room anymore. And then something kind of sparked in me that teachers needed a voice in Denver, and so I ran for office and I won. So that's kind of what I've been doing, is giving educators a voice in Denver.
I've heard that you were named Teacher of the Year maybe more than once.
No, you can only have that honor once. But yes, I was. Quite the honor to be named that, because there's a lot of competition.
So your district has been a swing seat for many years, but not in 2020. What changed for you this cycle?
I'm a pretty moderate Democrat, and I think this district needs moderate representatives, because I don't just represent the people who voted for me. I represent everybody. And there's always a portion of people who do not vote for me, but I still represent them and I want to listen to them. And I think because I take the time to really reach out to my constituents and I listen, I pay attention to what they're doing and saying, I think that resonates well with them. They don't have to vote for me, but at least I'm listening to them.
COVID-19 has had severe impacts on public health, the economy, all kinds of things. Can you tell us about what you've witnessed in Southwest Colorado this year, and also what you've heard about from your constituents?
I think the biggest thing I hear about is the restaurant. Understandably, COVID has, you know, all the rules and regulations that have come down have really hurt what is very, very important to my district and all of Southwest Colorado for that matter, and that's keeping our restaurants open. But it's really hard to compare to say, why does Walmart get to be open or something like that, and restaurants don't? And it's because when you go and shop and spend money at Walmart, you don't have to take your mask off. But it is very difficult in a restaurant not to take your mask off to enjoy what you're buying there. So we're trying all kinds of things. You know, I worked with city council in Durango, at least, you know, to get outdoor seating during the warmer months. And now that it's colder, it's so unfortunate that we are in a red zone as far as the state goes. And so there is no indoor eating in restaurants. And it's really hurting them. I wish I could do something. I did find out that CDPHE, Department of Health, has said that there is proof of a lot of bread in restaurants. And so that's one reason they need to shut them down, or at least, you know, to visiting diners. But I think we're also looking at things with the governor about something like what Mesa County has, the five-star, where if restaurants are following a list of regulations and being very safe, they can open partially, and that would really help the industry. So we're working really hard to see what we can do to get them back open again.
Faced with inaction in Congress on COVID relief, Colorado Governor Jared Polis called legislators back to the Capitol after Thanksgiving, and you co-sponsored 3 of the 10 bills that passed in bipartisan fashion during what's called the 2020 extraordinary session earlier this month. You were also the prime House sponsor for 10 or 11 bills during the 2020 regular session. Let me start by asking you about a couple of the bills from the special session. Talk about the emergency relief programs for the child care sector, please.
People can't go to work if they have young children at home, especially if they're not in school doing homework there. We found a need and we addressed that need by opening up more child care centers and training, giving the opportunity to train more child care providers. So we had $45 million in grants to operators of these centers through two separate programs. And one's for existing operators, and the second will assist businesses that are expanding or just starting up. But it's a real need for people who want to go back to work and don't have a job where they can work at home.
When would the recipients of this additional funding from the special session expect to be able to have that money in hand at these facilities?
The grants have to be awarded by the end of February. I think it's February 28th.
Thanks. Well, another one that you co-sponsored, I'm speaking with Representative Barbara McLaughlin about the special session that just wrapped up at the beginning of December, was the Food Pantry Assistance Grant Program. And it seems like this is an issue that you've been working on long before COVID, but it came back up again.
Yeah, this one gives $5 million to food pantries. That's one thing that is really hard to handle is when people who live in one of the wealthiest countries in the nation do not have enough food on their table. They're scared or they don't want to go to a grocery store. They've lost their job. You know, everything else maybe you can do without, but you can't do without food. And if they have children who need to work hard in school, they need to be fed. So we gave money to food pantries. The money will be out by the end of March. It's really important. I mean, my Christmas gifts this year were I donated to food banks for all of my family because I think that's just a real need, and we need to make sure that everybody's fed. And when you donate like that, it's not like the stuff sticks around for a while. You want to get it out the door. They told me that their needs are 2 and 3 times what they've ever been before in District 59. So for me, this was a really important issue, was to address a very, very basic need of our constituents.
One survey from Hunger Free Colorado found 1 in 3 Coloradans struggling to afford meals. And we've also heard a lot of reports around the country of more and more people seeking food assistance who never have before.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and we sit in our house and we have a full pantry. And when it starts diminishing, we call up the grocery store and drive through and they put food in the back of our car. I just think many of us who have that luxury do not clearly understand how important it is and how lucky we are that we don't need the food pantry, because there are so many people, and like you said, more than ever, who do need that help.
One other bill from the 10 that were passed out of the special session that you co-sponsored was, working together with Senator Don Corum and others, the grants to improve internet access in public education here in Colorado. Now, you're the chair of the education committee, so I would expect that we could talk about education in Colorado all day. But just briefly here, what's significant about this right this minute?
Well, I think the pandemic really exposed what I call an ugly underbelly of what's really going on in Colorado. And the fact that you can tell everybody to go home and do schooling online, that's great if you have internet, if you have a computer, if you have a computer for every child in the household. There's just so many inequities that have gone on. And a lot of it is rural. Some of it is, you know, downtown Denver doesn't have that either. And so this money will go out per district and really help people with their specific needs. We have a public library in Durango, and people are always lined up in the parking lot because and doing their internet work because they don't have internet in La Plata County in many, many places. So this is really helpful for the schools. We're asking them to do online work. So now we have to put our money where our mouth is and say, you may have to be online, you may have to do school from online, but here are the tools to work with. It's really important for education right now.
My guest is State Representative Barbara McLaughlin. According to the official ledge.colorado.gov website, during the regular session, you are a prime sponsor on, I believe, 6 bills that went on to be signed by the governor. Before we go there, I just want to ask you about one of the bills that got away to implement recommendations for both elementary and secondary education from the state's Media Literacy Committee. Has there ever been a year when the need for stronger media literacy was more clear than 2020?
Oh, I clearly do not think so. Last year it was important. This year it's really important. I think adults and children need to be taught, you know, how to read the news. Where is the source coming from? Who is reliable? How do you check facts on Facebook? People share a post that they found, and really the headline says one thing and the story says another, and none of it is based on fact. But people reach out and they share these things without ever reading or understanding what is being said. We see it on both sides, left and right media. I think we just need to understand what we're learning, what we're listening to, what the facts are. There shouldn't be alternative facts. I just think it's really important now more than ever.
And so what's the future of the potential implementation? Because that one got tabled, right, during the regular session?
It did. And a couple years ago, Representative Cutter did a bill that just did a study of what this was. And so that money has already been paid out. The study has been done about media literacy in the schools. And programs are all ready. They have all kinds of websites and materials for teachers to use. What we want to do is when we are bringing this back this year, and this bill will just say that when you are changing curriculum, when you are revising curriculum, here's a couple places we would like you to put this media literacy in. So it's not something that teachers have to do immediately. It's not adding something to their plate right now. But when they come around to changing curriculum, which they have to do every few years, the materials will be there for them. You know, we'll give examples and they can take it from there.
Well, of the six bills that you authored in the regular session in the first half of 2020, what was your favorite? Which one do you really want to talk about before we run out of time today?
I think the one about college credit for work experience. There's a lot of people who graduated from high school through the years who didn't think they could go to college. They didn't have the money for college. They may not have had the grades for college. And so naturally, they went into other kinds of businesses, and they're probably very successful. And this bill will give them college credit for that work experience. And if they got any certificates along the way, they would get college credit for that. And we're hoping, and what the business community has said, is that there's a lot of people who, if they started out and they had a semester's worth of credit already, they would happily go back to college. And perhaps that college degree could get them, you know, a pay raise, a different career path. There's all kinds of choices that you can make with a college degree. And so this just opens up the possibility and the opportunity for people who never thought they wanted to go to college or didn't when, you know, the typical time of graduating from high school, and they can go on their way now. It just gives them that chance.
And when does your college credit for work experience bill take effect?
Starting in January, it'll start defining everything, and the Department of Higher Education has been working on what credits go with what work experience and things like that, so that all the colleges are on board with it. It'll be for state schools, so we're really excited about it.
One last bill I want to check with you on very quickly, because I think it will be near and dear to the hearts of KVNF listeners and supporters of independent media, is the Colorado Student Free Expression Law update that was House Bill 1062. Now, was this kind of more of a cleanup bill as opposed to a big new overarching law?
It was a cleanup bill. I have a degree in journalism, and I taught high school journalism for 20 years at Durango High School. So anything that has to do with this was really important to me. All of our First Amendment laws had to do with newspaper. It didn't have anything to do with broadcast or internet or anything like that. So this expands it to say that all of these sources of news for students are all covered under the First Amendment, that you have the right. In Colorado, students kind of take charge. Our law here says that students get to decide what goes into the paper with the help of their advisor, and the principal doesn't get to veto anything in the newspaper. So it gives students the opportunity to, you know, practice their constitutional rights, kind of teaches them a lot about that, I think. And this just opens it up to this all forms of media that students might be producing.
And that expansion means that the law is more caught up with all the different ways that students might be expressing themselves right now. But it also seems like it reiterates that it's probably a good thing for administrators to be able to point to the law and say, if you don't like something that the students ran in the paper, don't come after me, the principal, because this is protected speech.
Mm-hmm. It is. You know, we always say how important the First Amendment is, but this really helps students who should know how very, very important it is. It helps them practice this.
Well, I am so pleased to finally meet you, Representative Barbara McLaughlin. Thank you so much for letting me give you a call in Durango today and speaking on KVNF. Look forward to learning more about your work on the Education Committee in the 2021 General Session. Sounds like you'll be getting back to work with your colleagues January 13th, and hope we can talk some more during the upcoming session.
Okay, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to meet you too. Thank you.
You're tuned to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Gavin Dahl. Next up, Ian Silveri on the phone, the leader of Denver-based liberal advocacy group Progress Now and a biweekly columnist for the Denver Post. Thanks for taking my call, Ian.
Oh, man, it's so great to talk to you, Gavin. How you doing?
Good. You've worked for the Democratic Party inside the state capitol and led an activist organization outside the capitol. In the decade plus that you've been active in Colorado politics, you've seen some wild stuff. How does 2020 compare?
The most wild. It was an election that we thought would be pretty good for progressives and Democrats in Colorado and throughout the country. And in Colorado, we did not disappoint. Whereas in various parts of the country, there were competitive U.S. Senate races or competitive congressional races or even battles for legislative chambers that were unsuccessful for the blue team. Here in Colorado, we swept. Democrats kept 41 seats in the state House of Representatives out of 65, ran their total in the Senate up to 20 out of 35 seats, defeated Cory Gardner by over 9 percentage points, and delivered a 13.5-point victory for President-elect Joe Biden. That is a progressive election cycle unlike any other ever in Colorado's history.
So we watched a lackluster Democratic candidate, former Governor John Hickenlooper, crush an incumbent Republican, U.S. Senator Cory Gardner, in the general election. Is Colorado still a purple state?
You know, it's a question I get a lot. And what I was saying, I have to stick to what I was saying. And I think you and I may have talked about this after 2018. I said, if 2020 is as good or better, or at least as good as 2018, then I think Colorado is a blue state. Here we are. I think it's really hard to argue otherwise at this point.
So thinking about the reach of your organization, Progress Now, out of roughly 2 million Democratic voters in Colorado, let's say 1.5 million voters for everyone else, what do you estimate is the number of progressives in Colorado?
It's a great question. You know, we conducted an exit poll at the end of the last election to kind of see what we were dealing with here in terms of what parties or how people identified or this and that and the other thing. And something that we found that was really interesting is that unaffiliated voters overwhelmingly voted for Joe Biden and John Hickenlooper in this last election by 25 points in the presidential race and by 18 points in the U.S. Senate race. So Biden picked up 61% of unaffiliated voters in this last election and John Hickenlooper picked up 58%. That is a durable winning number that Democrats can continue to build power on. And that is a very, very scary number if you're a Republican in Colorado and are looking to find a way to recapture some power in the state.
So you wrote in a recent Denver Post column, quote, President Donald Trump lies so frequently and with such reckless abandon that in 4 years he has managed to eat away at the very foundation of truth itself. For millions of his followers, we are today not merely a country bitterly divided along political lines, but divided into competing versions of reality itself, unquote. So as you look around the country at people clinging to this narrative that Trump has justifiable cause for refusing to concede the election a full month after it was called by the Associated Press and other places, do you think more Republicans are victims of bad misinformation or just sore losers who won't admit the other team won?
It's such a good question. I'm not sure I can rank and order the proportion of suckers versus grifters, but I think that it's a mix of both, and I think it's a real problem. I mean, never before in American history, we've had plenty of close elections. We've had contested elections. I mean, 37 days after the 2000 election, Al Gore finally conceded to George W. Bush after recounts in Florida did not turn up additional votes for him. But we've never had these like competing versions of reality, like you pointed out. I was a philosophy major in college, and we studied epistemology, which is the theory of knowledge. How do you know things? How do you know what you know? What is truth? These fun, deep questions. And Donald Trump has forced us to re-examine the very foundation of truth itself because, you know, we had the whole alternative facts debate a couple of years ago. But here we are when the votes have been tallied, the elections have been certified, the Electoral College has cast their votes, and Joe Biden, with 306 Electoral College votes, which, by the way, is the exact same number of Electoral College votes that Donald Trump received against Hillary Clinton in 2016 in an election he referred to as a landslide at the time. Those votes are certified. Those elections have been audited, including here in Colorado, where we do this really fun risk-limiting audit that involves a bunch of 10-sided dice. It kind of looks like a game of Dungeons and Dragons. But ultimately, we were able to validate and verify the elections, debunk the wild amount of misinformation and disinformation coming from the Trump campaign or conservative interests or conservative quote-unquote news outlets, and really get to the bottom of the fact that this election was not close. It was the largest and highest turnout election in the entire country's history. Colorado had the second highest turnout of any state in the entire country. Minnesota won once again. They beat us in 2018 as well. We're coming for the crown in 2022, though. And ultimately, This election was not close either on the Electoral College side or the popular vote side. So the only folks who are still clinging to the idea that this was rigged or somehow manipulated or stolen or anything like that are partisans or people who are trying to profiteer off of partisans. Indeed, this week in the state legislature, the Republican chairwoman of the bipartisan bicameral legislative audit committee, Lori Sane, who you may remember was arrested for trying to bring a loaded gun onto an airplane at Denver International Airport, called a hearing, invited Jenna Ellis, a Colorado Christian University affiliated attorney for the Trump campaign who's been running around with Rudy Giuliani, A, catching and spreading COVID, and B, spreading mis and disinformation about the validity of the election and its results, went in front of a legislative panel, called tons of witnesses, hours of testimony, and provided absolutely no evidence of any kind of widespread electoral or voter fraud in Colorado or anywhere else.
My guest is Ian Silveri from Progress Now. You wrote another column for the Denver Post back before the election about the GOP's missing platform. What else besides Trumpism is left?
Well, it's such a good question. I mean, literally, the reason why I wrote this column was because I had gone on a hunt to find the party platforms for everyone from the Libertarian Party of Colorado to the Unity Party of Colorado, the Democratic and Republican parties and the Greens and everybody else as well. And the literal 2020 Republican Party platform was, we support the president's America First agenda. I'm paraphrasing, but it was roughly that, because Trump has become the party and the party has become Trump. And what you're seeing with people like Cory Gardner and other U.S. senators and other representatives refusing to acknowledge Joe Biden as the rightful winner of the election and as the president-elect, what they're doing is they are so terrified of the frothing at the mouth Trump base who vote for people like Lauren Boebert in Colorado's Congressional District 3, who live in this alternative universe where elections can be stolen or rigged despite the fact that they are distributed and decentralized throughout the country, or, you know, China or Iran or George Soros or some other invented boogeyman is out there flipping votes with fake algorithms that don't exist in voting machines. Like, you're seeing all this stuff collide and collapse, and at the end of the day, the Republican Party used to stand for things. In fact, if you ask most voters, hey, what's a Republican and what's a Democrat? You ask them what's a Republican, they say something like, I don't know, low taxes, maybe they're bad on abortion, small government, like things like that, big business is okay. You ask them what's a Democrat, they actually have a harder time coming up with like a political or policy framework to describe a Democratic Party, because there are so many answers to questions when you try and go forward and so few when you try and go backward. But at the end of the day, the party has become Trump, to the point where he's already talking about possibly running again in 2024 for president, scrambling the dreams of people like Marco Rubio, who think they should be president for some reason. So I think at the end of the day, the party has become Trump and Trump has become the party, which means they don't actually stand for anything except for protection of Trump's fragile ego and the projection of this sort of like strongman image that he attempted to cultivate and successfully did so with a portion of the electorate.
As shocking as it can feel, the reality is for many of today's Republican Party officials, it's difficult to condemn violent white supremacist groups like the Proud Boys. Why is that?
I have no idea. You'd have to ask them. It seems like the easiest thing in the world to say. And Cory Gardner, to his credit, after Charlottesville in 2017, did say that. He said there is no room in the Republican Party for white supremacists. There is no room in the party for overt racists. There is no room in the party for violence like what was experienced in Charlottesville. He then never, ever mentioned anything like that again, even though there were repeated incidents along the lines of what happened, the tragedies that happened in Charlottesville that day throughout the rest of President Trump's term, including his remarkable request to the quote-unquote Proud Boys to stand back and stand by when he was asked a question about hate groups in the United States. But the Southern Poverty Law Center, the ADL, and other groups that monitor hate activity throughout the state and throughout the country have noticed a marked increase in racial violence, a marked increase in vandalism of synagogues. Just last week, when there were these protests going on through D.C. In support of President Trump somehow winning an election that he clearly lost. These yellow and black clad, quote unquote, Proud Boys vandalized historically black churches, burned Black Lives Matter flags, and all sorts of things like that. So at the end of the day, it should be the easiest thing in the world. And hey, if Cory Gardner can do it, I think anybody can, to condemn violent white supremacists. And yet this president and many of his supporters refuse to do that.
One more question on President Trump. Touching on COVID-19, how much worse do you think this pandemic has been for public health due to the president gaslighting the American people, promoting snake oil solutions, and hosting or promoting so many super spreader events?
You know, it's such an important question, and it's one that I thought for sure the spell would break when people started dying by the hundreds of thousands. This week, we crossed 300,000 dead Americans due to complications from the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic. I have an 11-month-old child. I have a compromised immune system. I have an autoimmune disease. I have in-laws and family members who are sick or older or vulnerable to this sort of thing. And the simple fact that we could have saved hundreds of thousands of lives by everybody participating together and putting a cloth over their face when they go out in public. And now that we have a vaccine or more than one vaccine coming online, of course, you're seeing people agitating against taking it. I will be one of the first people in line to receive that vaccine. As a matter of fact, I would let Donald Trump Jr. shoot it into my neck with a blow dart if that was the only way to receive it, because I think it is so important for us as a community, us as Americans, us as Coloradans, to do what we can to protect each other. I think that countless lives could have been saved. I mean, it's hard to prove a counterfactual like that, but I do know that it would have been hard to have done worse on purpose than we did this way.
You're listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm speaking with Ian Silveri from Progress Now, Colorado's largest progressive organization. Our other guest last week on Local Motion was moderate Republican State Senator Don Corum. You've disagreed with him on plenty of bills at the Capitol, of course, but it seems like he wielded more power than many people realized over the past decade, because bill sponsors on both sides of the aisle wanted him to support their legislation. At the national level, Congresswoman-elect Lauren Boebert, by contrast, campaigned on a promise not to compromise. Are politicians like Don Corum going the way of the buffalo, and is it the extremists who are killing them off?
Well, we're all going the way of the buffalo, Gavin, but I think Senator Corum, I consider Senator Corum a friend for a very long time. I knew him when he was in the House and I was a House staffer. I've watched his career. We talk infrequently these days, but whenever we do, it's with a great deal of admiration and respect for one another. I'm a big fan of his, and I think that in places like Montrose, where there's a lot more of a common sense approach to politics and policy, where it's not necessarily as partisan, it's just go down to Denver, get things done for the community, and don't like get in our way or mess with our lives, I think that you can be a really successful bipartisan politician. Additionally, State Senator Kevin Priola and State Senator Bob Rankin, two more Republicans who were in districts that were widely considered to be highly vulnerable in this last election, both narrowly survived strong challengers from Democratic opponents in those districts. So those three senators, in fact, are known widely in Colorado for their bipartisan work and their credential to just go down to Denver and get things done for people in the district, work with Democrats, Republicans, or whomever in order to deliver policy victories. So I think that Senator Corum has been a model of a modern Colorado Republican, somebody who understands that while their caucus or their party might not be in power, they can still go work collaboratively with the other side, find common ground on issues they agree on, and really get things done for the people in their districts and the people of the state. I've long admired that about Senator Corum, and I'm not surprised that he emphasized that. Conversely, when you think about someone like Congresswoman Boebert, I mean, you do have to hand it to her, because her mission was not that easy, or at least it didn't seem that way when she first started running. Taking out an incumbent congressperson, Scott Tipton, who had been in office since he was first elected in 2010, was a real big challenge. He had high name ID. He was the chairman of Colorado's Trump reelection program, and she prosecuted a case against him that, despite all those things and having the president's endorsement, he was not pro-Trump enough. So it harkens back to an earlier question about Trumpism. What is this? Is it conservatism? Is it Republicanism? No, it's its own thing that is completely subsumed by the president, his personality, his ego, his positions, his communication style, his approach, his values, if you can call them that, versus someone like Don Corum, who has traditional fiscal conservative credentials, but actually believes that government can be used as a force of good in a limited sense in order to help people live their lives better without telling them what to do or how to live their lives.
We're going to have to leave it there. Very excited to get a chance to get Ian Silveri on the phone, leader of Denver-based liberal advocacy group Progress Now and a biweekly columnist for the Denver Post. Last week on Local Motion, we heard from two Republicans. This week, two Democrats. Check out both shows on our website, kvnf.org. Ian, thanks so much for your time.
Gavin, always a pleasure. We'll talk to you soon, man. Thanks.